Hey, indie filmmakers, I'm Griffin Hammond.
I'm Nick Bodmer, and today we're talking about YouTube's new copyright checks feature, which flags any copyright restrictions or ad suitability issues during the upload process.
So yeah, this is a new feature that I only encountered last time I uploaded a video, and I actually worried that I had done something wrong.
You saw something new and you're like, oh God, what happened now?
It's funny, I looked at my last few videos that I've uploaded, and two of them are those Mars Rover videos, mm-hmm. which were flagged for copyright because they have the song Don't Stop Me Now by Queen in them.
Right.
And so I wondered if, like, oh no, half of my latest uploads have copyright claims against them. Maybe that's why I'm being checked. But it turns out this is a feature.
Like you've been flagged.
Right.
But no, new feature.
Yeah. You actually got an email about this.
YouTube sent me an email. I'm sure probably most of our audience got it too if they have YouTube accounts. But after you've uploaded the video and before you hit publish, it will actually tell you any of the issues, if there's a content ID match or if there's something that's going to make it so you can't run ads. Puts all that up front and you can make changes and stuff before you publish, which would have been very handy when I was doing wedding videos that often, you know, like a reception video and people would be dancing and there's a, you know, an Elvis song in the background, which always get flagged for copyright and shut down. So that would be nice to have had that.
Well, so I actually started uploading, I uploaded a 7-minute video right as we were starting this recording. And it told me right off the bat, when I got to the checks stage, it said that the copyright check would take 4 minutes to complete and the ad suitability check would take 19 minutes to complete. It actually seems like it went faster than that. They're both done, and it says no issues found. So I guess on this test video, YouTube is ready for me to put ads on it, and they're not going to flag it.
Do you know what do they mean by ad suitability? What are they checking for beyond copyright stuff? Do you have any idea?
Well, let's see. Let me go back to where it asks the questions. Yeah. When you upload, because do you run ads on your YouTube channel, right?
I don't have any idea. No? I don't think I have in order to make money, you have to have a certain number of like subscribers and stuff, which I don't meet. So
even your very popular hard drive shucking video, that's just completely not monetized.
That's correct. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So yeah, you don't see these then when you upload a video. When I upload a video, there is the main details page where I plug in the title and description. The next page is monetization, where I choose if I want to be monetized and what that might look like. And then the third page is ad suitability, which asks me a series of questions. They want to know if your video is full of inappropriate language, which the podcast almost never is. Do we ever have adult content on the podcast? Like
no,
sexual pretty, behavior and language? No.
Pretty clean here.
Yeah. There's violence, shocking content, harmful or dangerous acts. You're pretty much just saying yes or no to each of these. Recreational drug use, or talking about it, I guess, or content related to recreational use of drugs. Hateful and derogatory content, firearms related content, sensitive events, and controversial issues. Which
I don't think
I know
think
that
we,
last one.
We don't check any of those boxes. We're pretty boring.
No.
So
usually,
how are we going to go viral without all those things?
Right. We can't, yeah. Usually at the bottom of this list, I just check the none of the above category. The last one, controversial issues, has been an issue, especially when I work in news. It's always been this question of like, what do you mean we can't talk about the news of the day? I mean, so many issues could be controversial. It could be a very broad category if you're not willing to talk about politics or... but I do like the way they've described it here. YouTube says controversial issues, topics that may be unsettling for our users, which makes me think you should be able to talk about a lot of things.
Right. And you would assume, I was going to say you'd assume as a news organization you would get more leeway, but that's probably not the case because it's all automated, right?
Well, YouTube does work with news organizations because I know this has been a problem over the years about can you monetize news, and sometimes you couldn't. But I think they've tried to get better at that. So I guess what confuses me about the new checks system is that this copyright check and the ad suitability check happen live. I guess that's kind of cool that I get a countdown, essentially. It tells me how long it's going to take. But until you kind of explained it, I didn't really understand, like, why do you see the value of it happening now versus happening later? Well, like, if anything, I interpreted it the opposite way. I was like, what, you're going to stop me from uploading something?
I mean, wouldn't you want to know if all of a sudden you're not going to be able to monetize a video because of a song you put in there or something? Wouldn't you want to know that before you publish it to the world so you can fix that?
Right. I guess you're right. So you're saying a normal workflow would be you upload your wedding video, you're all excited, you send it to your client, the client's all excited, and then 3 days later it gets taken down.
Gets taken down or something. Yeah.
I see. Yeah. Okay.
That's what I immediately thought of, at least.
No, I think you're right. I didn't fully understand why it was, because I mean all my videos get checked for copyright. I just didn't understand why it mattered if it was now or later.
Yeah. But then I'm confused. Let me ask you this. So the ad suitability thing, you said it's all these questions that you answer, but then it's you said it was going to take 18 minutes or something. So it's obviously scanning the video's content to validate that. Is it actually analyzing if it hears the word coronavirus or something like that to make sure you're not spewing misinformation? Is that kind of what's happening, you think?
I bet it is. I bet it's doing some sort of, like, the same way it comes up with an automatic caption.
Closed captioning.
For the video.
Yeah.
It can probably, as it's doing its automatic captioning, it's looking for some keywords. And it may be, I'm sure, each advertiser that does work with Google AdWords and with YouTube, I'm sure they plug in their own words that they don't want to be associated with. Like,
sure.
You know, if you're talking about beer the entire video, maybe a particular drink company doesn't want to be associated with that, or they worry about that you'd be talking about their competitor or something. Maybe they just want to stay away from it entirely.
Do you think now that we're talking about these words that this video will not be monetizable anymore?
We've been talking about controversy and violence and drugs. Actually, that will be funny.
Yeah, we'll have to update in the comments if we get flagged for anything because of the meta discussion going on.
Yeah. Well, and I do think seeing it do this and seeing how quickly it can do it, it's clearly still an audio-based thing. Because as soon as I saw this happening on the last episode, I worried because our episode about NFTs, I was using a lot of B-roll of other people's art. The stop motion video that we were talking about, I showed. Later in the episode, we talked about that FPV drone video called Right Up Our Alley that is so popular. Right. And I showed a pretty significant amount of that and even played some audio from it. And so I worried that somehow this episode full of B-roll would get flagged, but it didn't. So I think it really is looking for music primarily and probably some inappropriate
words. Which makes
sense. Yeah. And then I don't see myself using this. I don't know if you would use this either. It looks like if it does find a copyright issue, it gives you perhaps more resolutions than it did before. It allows you to chop out the music, replace the music, cut out that section entirely, which I'm not sure if that was a feature you could do previously.
Interesting.
Like just remove a section of the video.
Who in the world would ever use that? I guess if you weren't really a creator and you just uploaded something really long and you're like, fine, I don't care, just want it up, so take out.
Yeah,
what you
maybe
don't
if
want.
You're not much of an editor, I don't know. But yeah, in your case and mine, I think we would just undo the upload and start over.
Right.
Just edit that clip out or something. Well, yeah, I guess if anyone encounters any weird issues with this new automated checks feature, I'd love to hear about it in the comments and we can try to get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
We did get a question from Dan about copyright that I think applies in some way. Because I think one of the things I want to talk about today is how, especially as we see this copyright check system on YouTube, copyright is a much more complicated issue than just what is legal. It's also kind of what's allowable. Like, YouTube is not saying you've done something illegal if you've broken copyright. They're just saying they're going to treat your video differently.
Right.
So do you want to read this question we got?
Sure, yeah. So Dan asks, I've been doing freelance video work for a few years and I filmed a few musicals and ballet performances. The school pays me my day rate for the filming, plus they pay me to make DVDs and Blu-rays. Does the school's licensing of the music cover me?
What would your
good question?
Guess your instinct be here.
My instinct would be it depends.
Yeah.
But probably yes, because in general, what I've found is schools and things like that are pretty cognizant of the copyright they're granted when they put on a performance like that. I've had my hand slapped in my school days of doing theater for recording musicals live that we did not have a license to do. So there are certainly situations where the performance license does not permit a copy like that. But I'm certain that there are certain licenses that would allow that. So that's probably a question you want to ask before you take a job like that, just to be safe, I would think.
What do you think? Well, and I had some back and forth messages with Dan, and it did sound like he talked to the school about it, and they assured him that they had the proper licensing for the music. But I feel like even if they didn't, even if the school was committing some sort of copyright infringement, I actually feel like Dan would be okay here because he's
acting as an employee. Yeah.
Well, he's not even as an employee, but he's acting as a freelancer for his client. I'm pretty sure, again, whenever we talk about copyright, we're not lawyers, so we could be getting it wrong, and you shouldn't base your... This is not legal counsel we're giving you. But I do think that when they pay him for the video, they are the owners of the copyright of that video. Like, he's it's not his video. He made a video for a client. It's their video. So I think it's their copyright issue to resolve. If they broke the law, that's not on Dan. That's on them, I believe.
Right. You know, sometimes I've seen, though, like, you know, somebody records a school performance or something, and you can go buy the DVD or CD directly from them, you know, like parents would buy it from the person who did the video, then you might be in a little more questionable area. But if the school
I'm glad you brought that up.
Then, go ahead.
Because it sounds like Dan was also doing that. And that was something I was trying to get to the bottom of when I was talking to him. It sounds like he has two different clients. There's the school. But then also some of these ballets he does, they're like a dance company that comes in and uses the school. And again, it sounds like they may have the proper licensing. But in that case, they were not paying him at all. They were just allowing him to come in, film, make DVDs, and then sell them directly to customers. And that's definitely iffier, because now he is the one creating the work, and the work is... not relying on their license. He doesn't have the license.
It's an interesting question.
I still think whenever we talk about copyright, it's never black and white. If anyone never tries to tell you there's like a rule like, oh, you're allowed to use 7 seconds of something, 7 seconds of a song, and that's legal. That's not a thing. It's never that black and white in copyright. And it's always a mix of what the law is and what would happen if you ever went to court, and even like just what your risk tolerance is, and kind of the likelihood that you would ever get in trouble. Because I think in this case, if he was selling the DVDs without a license for the music, he's definitely infringing on someone's copyright. But if you're a record company and you're making a song that's really popular with kids to dance to, that kids like to dance to at their recitals, I'm not sure you want to come after people who are making videos of, like, he's not hurting the market for the song.
Right.
It's not like people are going to be like, you know what? I'm going to watch this dance video instead of going to YouTube and listening to the song or listening to it on Spotify.
Right.
So it's a very low risk thing, I think.
Makes sense. Or like when you made your Mars Rover video, you used Don't Stop Me Now, and you didn't have a license for it, right?
Right, and here's another example of how messy copyright gets, that YouTube tells me that is, I mean, in fact, how do they even phrase it in my, let's see, they phrase it as a copyright claim. Yeah, YouTube's not saying I've broken the law, they're just saying there's a copyright claim against my video. And here's where copyright gets so messy, that I believe that I have made something transformative. I've mixed NASA footage, which my understanding is it's public domain because it's paid for by tax dollars. So I should be able to use as much NASA footage as I want without ever getting in trouble. And I've mixed it with a commercial song. And you could argue that I'm taking away market for the song. You might watch my video instead of listening to the original, but I'm using not the entire song. I've cut it up in a creative way. I've also like added reverb in places. I've messed with it so it sounds different. Not to try to get around anything, but like there were times when I wanted it to sound very distant on Mars, like it's in the space. And I've cut it specifically so certain lines of the song land on certain visuals. Like, I think I'm trying to make a point about this song and its relationship to this footage. So I would make an argument that it's a fair use, that I've transformed it. I'm not hurting the market for this song. And I think it's a standalone, unique piece of art. It's a mashup.
It's a mashup. But let me just make sure I understand this. You have no recourse. YouTube's not going to let you monetize that video, and you really have no real recourse.
Yeah, I don't think so. Let's see. I may be able to dispute it. Let's see if it lets me. Yeah, I can dispute it. So right now, YouTube knows that I've used Don't Stop Me Now by Queen. It, like, identified that. Presumably, they have a deal with UMG, the copyright owner, the record company. And this is why I kind of love this feature of YouTube, that it lets me make this video and publish it, even though it has a problem with it. Like, UMG is just saying, we don't want them to make money off of it. And if they do make money, or, you know, if YouTube wants to run ads on it, just give us the money instead. So the money's going to the record company.
Yeah.
But I do have the option. Yeah, I have four options here. I can trim out the segment, which would be like the entire video. I can replace the song. I'm not going to do that. I can mute the song. Not going to do that. That'd be really stupid. Or I can dispute it. And I suppose I could dispute it.
I wonder what would... I mean, my guess is you have very little chance of winning a dispute, though, right?
Right. And that's the thing. Like, YouTube is not a court of law. And that's where I think this distinction is important, that I think I've done something legal. I've stepped on copyright, certainly, but we have a provision in the law called fair use where there are reasons you can step on someone else's copyright, whether it's education or news or parody or it's particularly transformative. There's a lot of reasons, or you didn't use very much. I do think I could win in a court of law. YouTube doesn't care about that, though. They just care about, like, making the record companies happy. And so they're not in the business of telling me whether I did what I did was legal or not. They're just in the business of saying, does this piss off the record companies or not?
Yeah. and the record company is more important than Griffin.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that's an important distinction to know as a video producer.
Yep.
It reminds me of when I worked at Bloomberg Television. We would, you know, I think anytime you're a video producer, you should get to know the lawyers that work at the company, and, you know, you can run a lot of things past them and get some great counsel from them. And I've been fortunate to work with a lot of great lawyers in my career that didn't want to shut things down but wanted to help. But I do remember at Bloomberg, they would let us do a lot of things and give us a lot of great advice. But anytime we even tried to touch anything related to Star Wars, the lawyers were like, just don't even do it.
Like, it's just not worth the amount of headache that it will come with trying.
Right. This was back when, I mean, I suppose now Star Wars is owned by Disney, right?
But yep.
They used to be owned by Fox Corporation. And back when it was owned by Fox, I'm imagining that every other cease and desist letter they received was from Fox Corporation about one of their pieces of intellectual property. And so they were just, you know, they were like, don't use the music from Star Wars. Don't use any video from Star Wars. We're just going to get instantly in trouble. And again, it's not a question of, is it fair use or not? Maybe it was definitely fair use what we were doing, but it's just that if you're always being sued by the same company, it's understandable that your lawyers be like, maybe don't touch that one. We just don't want to deal with the hassle anymore. So again, copyright is a lot bigger than what's legal or what's not.
Risk assessment.
Yeah,
the risk assessment on that one was high.
Yes.
And therefore, not worth it.
Well, yeah, one of my big questions coming into this episode was, can you appeal a demonetization? I figured you could, but I don't think I've ever actually tried. I've just accepted.
Well, you should try, and we can watch your account slowly get disabled.
Right.
Griffin is off the internet.
But yeah, I think if I had done something, you know, I think, like, I feel pretty good about the fair use argument on a video like my Mars Rover video, but I know it's a little bit iffier than, like, a news thing. I think if I'd been making a video where we were talking about the song Don't Stop Me Now and its important cultural impact. You know, if I was making some point about the song in text and voice, I think it'd be a little bit clearer that it's a news commentary about the song. And I think I would dispute that if YouTube tried to shut that down, especially if I was only using 10 seconds of the song or something. Well, why don't we take a quick break, and after our sponsor break, we will answer questions about documentary storytelling, the microphones that we use, and lens filters.
Handy Filmmakers is brought to you by Squarespace. From websites and online stores to marketing tools and analytics, Squarespace is the all-in-one platform to build a beautiful online presence and run your filmmaking business.
I was just doing a bit of like spring cleaning on my website, on my Squarespace site. I went in and was updating a few facts and things. And one of the things I noticed when I went to share my site, like on Facebook, you know, there's that little like preview image that pops up anytime you share a website. And it mm-hmm. was this pretty old picture of me at a trade show like NAB with headphones on. And I just realized like I have better pictures of myself doing filmmaking stuff. And so I thought, well, how can I change that? And sure enough, right in the settings for every single page, you can adjust the social image, which is the image that shows up as a preview when you share it to Facebook or Twitter or something. On the About Me page, I picked a portrait of me. On the podcast part of the website, I put you and me, Nick.
I'm in there.
So that's just one of those easy-to-use functions that I really appreciate on my Squarespace site.
Check out squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/griffin to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Thank you, Squarespace.
We got an Instagram message from Jay, who is a corporate videographer, and he's about to shoot his first short doc, and he's going to keep it pretty short. It's going to be 2 minutes long, but he's having trouble figuring out what story to tell within those 2 minutes. He says that this guy is pretty interesting, and he's spent a few hours learning about this guy's life, but he's just wondering how to even consider what should go into, how do you choose?
That's a tough one, right? That's, I think we've talked about something before. You know more about it than I do. Is it the story circle? Am I remembering it right?
Yeah. Yeah, Dan Harmon's story circle, which is, I mean, you should Google it if you're not familiar with it, but it's in eight parts to a story. There, you need, go, search, find, take, return, change. And Dan Harmon's argument has always been, you can do this in 30 seconds, you can do it in 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 30 minutes. So I would consider looking at that. But I think to get to, I agree with Jay that it can be difficult to take like someone's whole exciting life and boil it down to 2 minutes, definitely. So I think my instinct would be, knowing how short that is, to focus on something that's useful to the audience. You know, certainly this guy has learned something really valuable in his life, in his exciting life, that he could share with people. I mean, even if he was just like doing a Q&A with some students in college, I'm sure they would ask him like, what advice would you have for young people trying to get into the same industry? And I feel like even if you just answered that question, it could be in story form, like how did he learn that valuable lesson? You know, he probably did something really cool to understand that might be a way to kind of get to what his story is and also come out of those 2 minutes with something really valuable for your audience, so they feel like, wow, I'm so glad I watched that and that's really cool.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you know, for a deep dive, do you know how long ago we talked about that story circle?
No.
Episode 18, Science of Storytelling. So, you know, I feel like, always good to go back to a classic like that.
Yeah. I feel like surely we've talked about it since then, but yeah.
Do you know how I found that? Your
you use
wonderful
the search
Squarespace
function.
I used the search function of your Squarespace site.
Yeah.
We're out of the ad now, but still it did work really well. I just put story circle in the search and it popped right up.
So, and I'll put that episode in the show notes. So if you go to hey.film right now and land on our podcast page, you'll see in this episode's show notes the link to episode 18, which, man, must have been in 2017, I think.
May 17th, 2017. Yeah. It does not look as good from a visual perspective. I'm just clicking through it now. My lighting has improved. Yours looks pretty good already, but
Where am I in the shot?
The living room in New York, it looks like.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I'm in my office at my old house with no real lights. Sorry. All right. I got us distracted.
You want to read this next question?
So we got a YouTube comment from at me with two E's. I have a question. Do you guys EQ your microphones, or is that the sound coming straight out of the blue mics? So we have the blue baby bottle microphones. The question is, what audio processing are we doing? And do you know what's interesting is I don't know, because I don't really edit this. I would assume you are doing... Here's what I would do. Can I say what if I like what yeah. I did on my latest video is I use... Oh, gosh, what's it called? Let me bring up Final Cut. Final Cut has actually a really nice... audio plugin called, I think it says called VoiceOver, but I think it does a compressor and a de-esser, which is valuable.
I think I'd seen that effect in there, but have never used it. I just use a compressor on our voices.
Well, there's the answer.
And I think a few years ago when we started the podcast, I played around with the compressor settings, and I think I kind of tweaked it to compress even more, like to lift up the lowest volumes even more. I can never remember all the terms for in a compressor effect, but I kind of ramped up the effect a little bit, knowing that generally in a podcast you want to hear us most of the time. And so I saved that as a preset. You can do that in Final Cut. You can make a bunch of settings to changes to an effect and then save it as a preset. So I have like a Hey Indie Filmmakers preset attached to the compressor effect in Final Cut, and I just apply that every time.
Oh, nice.
And then so I raise the volume a tiny bit.
You know, it's interesting. What would be a fun experiment is a de-esser can be very helpful. A de-esser takes the sibilant sounds and all these S's I'm saying. It's really just an EQ, and it punches down, where those S's hit so hard, and it can make it a little less harsh to listen to. Maybe I'll give you a de-esser setting. It'd be funny to hear me read the Squarespace ad twice, one with without the de-esser, because there's a lot of S's in that read. And I'll share a screenshot as well, Griffin. I just pulled up my Synology replication video that I haven't published yet, but I've got my all my settings that I put into my own voice. I can share what those look like. So the voiceover enhancement in Final Cut Pro 10 has the compressor, has a de-esser, and then it has just a basic EQ just to kind of punch up a male voice a little bit. So rolls it off like below 50 hertz to get rid of some of that booming. Drops a tiny bit at 500, and then about 2K and up, it starts to lift. So you get a little, just a crisper voice. And then the de-esser is set up for dialogue. And the compressor is set up as a punchy male voiceover. So that's my settings, and I can share those.
I will say that the only other things I ever have to do to our audio is your audio, because you record it in Audio Hijack, right?
That's right.
Into your computer. So when Nick sends me his audio, it always comes as a mono file already ready to go. My audio is going into my Zoom H5, which is set up as a stereo recording where there's two XLR inputs. One goes on the left side, one goes on the right side. So my audio always comes in as a left side only stereo clip, and I have to switch it to dual mono. And I always remember to turn off the second channel. It's probably doesn't sound like anything, although right now that I'm looking at my dials, I see that my second channel is turned up to like half volume. So if I were to listen to it, it probably would have some
noise,
some just little, tiny little hiss. So I always make sure to turn that off. And then every once in a while, I'll do some noise reduction. Like last episode, Nick's mic was a little bit further away from his mouth than usual. And I don't know why I'm talking about you in third person when you're right here with me.
You're talking to me, not the audience right now. Okay. they're just listening.
I'm talking about Nick over here. because your mic was a little bit further away, I think it was closer to your computer, which every once in a while I do hear your computer fan sound in the mic. And because it was further away from you, I had to turn it up a little bit more. So it just brought the whole noise floor up. And so it was noisier than usual. So I just sent the whole thing into Adobe Audition and did a little noise reduction on it and then brought it back in. Yeah. But that's, I don't usually do that. Maybe I've done that every 20 episodes or so.
You know, I saw a really useful video, got shared on Twitter, and I looked at it, about using a de-esser and things like that. So maybe I'll put that in the show notes, because I thought it was a great little 6-minute tutorial on doing voiceover in Final Cut. So I'll share that.
Our last question today is a YouTube comment that we got from Daniel, who was wondering how to know if a filter, like an ND filter, would fit on a lens. What filters fit on a Canon 50 millimeter lens?
Well, there's a a thread size to every lens, right?
Right.
And there's a huge variety. I know you've got some tricks for buying bigger ones and adapting them down, I believe. But I just always look at the tech specs on a lens to find out what the filter size is. Is that not the right way to do it?
No, that's right. And it usually says everything you need right on the ring of the lens. I mean, here I'm holding a Lumix 25 millimeter lens, and it tells me, it says 1:1.4. That's always the aperture. I've actually never looked up why they write the aperture that way instead of just writing f/1.4. Although I understand it's a ratio, so it makes sense to write it as 1:1.4 as well. And then it says 25. 25 is the millimeter focal length of this lens. But then you keep rotating around, and it has the little, I feel like that's a Greek symbol that I don't remember what it's called.
I know what you're talking about, but I don't know what it's called.
I can't remember. But yeah, a little circle with a line through it, and then it says 46, and that 46 is the filter, the thread diameter. I think it's diameter.
Millimeters?
Presumably, yeah.
Yeah.
And so...
And what's your trick? So you like to buy larger ones, and then you've got filter step-down adapters, right?
Yeah, like this is one of my smallest lenses, 46 millimeter thread size. I'm not going to buy a 46 millimeter filter for this when, like, the lens I'm shooting with right now is a 12 millimeter lens, and it has a 62 millimeter thread size. I'm not going to buy another one for this 46. So I have a series of step-up adapters. Like, here's a step-up adapter that gets me from 46 to 58, because 58 is another common one I have. But then I have even more step-up rings. I have one that gets me from 58 to, well, yeah, here's a big 77 millimeter filter I have, and I've put a 58 ring on the back, so I can put that on. I mean, I don't think there's no reason you can't use like 10 step-up rings if you needed to.
Right, because they're by design going to be outside the field of view, presumably, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, I suppose if you did a lot of little
like
tiny
fisheye.
Yeah, I mean, if you did too many and they were really small step ups, like if you were using 10 step up rings, that would actually be a problem. But I've never had a problem using like two or three.
You have a good video on ND filters, as I recall, too, right?
Yes, I'll put that in the show notes, how to know which ND filters to use on your lenses. But yeah, one of the takeaways of that is that I really only have like two primary sizes of NDs that I buy. I have a bunch of 77s, because I think I used to have some 77 millimeter lenses. I don't know if I do anymore. And I have a bunch of 67s, because I happen to have a lot of lenses that are 67. But then for my weird ones, like the 62, I just have a step-up ring. And for my 46, I have some step-up rings. And I actually do kind of like an inventory when I'm packing up for a shoot. Like, I'm bringing these three lenses. Let me see if I have... I don't really need to bring more step-up rings than are possible. Like, I could probably leave some of them at home if I'm not bringing the lens that they apply to.
And that's how you do that. That's going to be my new catchphrase.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. As a YouTuber, I'm always getting pitches about, like, selling merch. And merch is always, for YouTubers, just, like, t-shirts and hats and hoodies. And I just can't imagine what I would sell, because it's always supposed to be like catchphrases. It's like, what would people buy? But there you go. If you start introducing your new catchphrase, we can finally start selling some merch.
What's my thing I say all the time? I said it once in this episode, and I thought about it, and I've already forgotten what my little phrase is.
Well, people were making fun of you, I think, in the comments last episode, because you often say interesting.
Interesting. Something else I feel like I say all the time, but I can't remember what it is, but let me know in the comments. Yeah.
So, as you might hear a little bit in this episode, I mentioned that they're doing the drywall downstairs right now. We're getting closer to my office being done, and we were far enough along that I decided to go ahead and order a new projector.
Woohoo!
For downstairs. Because
movie theater.
I have a projector I've been using for a while. I think since like 2013 is when I bought it. It's just an HD projector, an Optima HD20 projector. I bought it used for $550 in 2013. It's fine, but in my new setup, I'm going a little bit bigger with the screen size. I'm going to do a 128-inch screen on a wall. Okay. And I'm putting it back a little bit further because the room is a little bit, it's got some size. I think it might be like 15 feet that I'm putting it away from the wall. And I worry with all these windows down there that I'm just going to be diluting how bright this thing is by putting it further in a brighter space, bigger projection. So that projector is a 1700 lumen projector. So I decided to upgrade to, is it the same one you have?
It's the same one I have, yeah.
Yeah. Which, this is the Epson, what is it, 5040 UB?
5040 UB, yeah. So it's a slightly older model. They have a 5050 now, but the 5040 UB is great because they've got them refurbished for half the price of what the 5050 is. And the 5050 is, it's better in some ways, but not twice as good. So I just think it's a tremendous value.
What does the 5050 cost? Like $3,000 or something?
At least, yeah. Something like that. So,
well, that's what's crazy.
I've been very pleased with mine.
Having not purchased a projector in so many years, I didn't realize how expensive they all are now. That, like, if you want a true 4K projector, they cost like $5,000 or $10,000.
True 4K is still very tough. Now, this BenQ does something, it's called pixel shift, I believe, where it's not actually, it doesn't have 4K actual pixels it presents, but it can do a shift, so it like alternates, and you get pretty darn close to 4K quality at a lot less money. So yeah. I've been very pleased with the 4K image I get out of it. It's 4K HDR.
Yeah, I don't fully understand the 4K pixel shift. I don't understand exactly how it works, but I understand that it definitely is an improvement over 1080. That it's a noticeable difference in clarity.
Yep. You're gonna love the image. The image is great, especially when you get the room dark. It really pops very nicely. So it'll be nice.
Because it sounds like even if it's not a true 4K image, pixel for pixel, it kind of sounds like it's still throwing 4K like number of pixels on the wall through its shifting.
That's right. Correct.
So you see more dots on the wall. But I think what primarily sold me was just knowing that I needed a brighter screen. I don't even know if I needed 4K because I'm pretty happy with how even the 1080 projector looks. But just this will be an upgrade from 1700 lumens to 2500 lumens for me. And I think that'll be helpful in this bigger
room. And just
room.
A far more modern projector. It's going to have way better contrast, way better colors.
Yeah.
It's HDR
capable, all these
things. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're going to really enjoy it. Have you decided officially then to go with a real screen and not just throw it on the wall?
Yes. Yeah, I'm going to get one of those silver ticket screens on Amazon.
Thank you.
I think both of these products that we're talking about, the screen and the projector, are both wire cutter picks. Although the projector is like an old wire cutter pick. I don't think it's their top one. I think
I did this 2 years ago, right? But at the time, the 5050 was like one of their step-up options. And they just said in the text somewhere, like, the 5040 was great. And if you can get it at whatever the price is, you know, definitely do that. They don't recommend, you know, stuff that isn't made anymore and is refurbished as their general recommendations, right. But they do, they called it out and said, hey, if you can get a hold of this, it's phenomenal value. And that's what I did.
Thanks, yeah, I think I saw the same thing, that they were recommending the 50/50, and underneath it just said, like, but also the 50/40 is very good. And yeah, I did the same thing. I ordered it as a, it was not even a refurbished model that I got. It's just an open box model. And
oh, even better.
It just arrived today. I haven't actually looked at it, but I'll make sure it has, that it looks like it's in good shape. And that I assume I can turn it on, go to the settings, and figure out how many hours it has on the lamp.
Right.
But it sounds like
very few.
Maybe someone took it home, turned it on, and then decided to return it, and that's fine by me. That's kind of what I want, is $400 off the retail price, and it's only got 2 hours of use on it or something.
On another episode, we'll have to start talking about your audio setup, because I have a feeling you're going to make me cry when you tell me what you're doing for audio. So,
oh, can I tell you what I'm going to do for audio and make you cry right now?
Oh, no. You're using those powered Mackie speakers or whatever?
That's what I want to do. So... here's what I'm trying to do to make this as simple. I'm trying to make my setup as simple as possible and use mostly the gear that I already have. Like, I used to have like four different devices going into my projector, like a PlayStation and a Roku and a Google Chrome device and all these things. And I never really used the PlayStation as a media player, but it looks like it's great. Like, it does that kind of like unified page where it shows you like Netflix stuff and Disney Plus stuff and everything in one place. You don't use your PlayStation as a media player, do you?
No.
But I think I might try at start, before even getting like a Roku 4K or something, just see what I can get away with on my current PS4 and decide in the future if I ever need to upgrade to a PS5. But I also realize, because it's always kind of a hassle to try to deal with audio with the projector, and I've looked at it over the years, and I don't really want to get a receiver and speakers dedicated just for the receiver. I have these monitor speakers, computer monitor speakers, that I've been using for a long time, and they're fine. And I tested out, you can plug them in via USB to the PlayStation, and the PlayStation will use them as their audio out. So that's what I'm going to try.
Okay. Okay.
You hate it because it's not hi-fi audio.
Well, you're gonna have such a great setup that it, you know, we're gonna need to talk about a receiver, and we're gonna need to talk about surround sound. Okay.
I mean,
did you I forgot to even ask. You didn't wire for in-ceiling speakers or anything, did you?
No. So it would necessarily have to be wireless speakers. I think one of the reasons I like the idea of this, at least as a preliminary setup, is I might just put the speakers behind me, or like on the sofa side of the setup, and then I don't have to deal with wireless across the room, because all my entertainment stuff is going to be on that back wall where the projector is. Like, I put HDMI in the wall from the floor to the ceiling. So I can...
You need the speakers by the screen.
I know. But, they'll necessarily have to be wireless if I do that. And then, yeah, then I have to go buy some wireless speakers and a new receiver, and I don't want to do that right away.
Oh, my gosh. All right.
Or at least I'm thinking about this anymore. In stages.
It's making me mad.
I'm thinking about this in stages. Like, I'm not going to start buying a bunch of gear before the room is even ready yet. So my plan is kind of like... Let's get a couch in there. Let's get the screen in there, the projector, and then figure out how to throw some content on it and kind of get a sense for the space before I start figuring out what is the next thing we need to upgrade.
Got it. All right. I'll stop bugging you about it. I don't like your answers, but that's okay.
Yeah.
It's not my space.
Also, who knows? I may find that, like, with our son sleeping, like, not all that far away from the movie room, I may find I'm doing most of like my video gaming and with headphones on anyway. You know, we'll see how we actually use it.
Okay. Headphones is not the worst answer.
Right.
All right, my friend. I think it's time to wrap it up.
Yeah. It was good talking
to you.
There's
another catchphrase for your mug. Wrap it up.
We're now selling Handy Filmmakers wraps for wintertime. Let's say.
Wrap it up. Cool. Well, hopefully I'm going to be publishing my Synology video soon. So look for that. Maybe before the next episode to drop.
Yeah.
Be exciting.
All right. Well, I'll talk to you soon.
See you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was totally just reading it live. I was pretty good. Actually, I was pretty proud of myself. Okay.
Except that it's unusable.
What did I say? Check.
You didn't make it plural.
I'm Nick Bodwin. Today we're talking about YouTube's new copyright checks feature.